is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. When FBI agents raided the offices of Evans Landscaping in July 2015, it was not clear what triggered their search. Now, 3 years later, owner Doug Evans and Vice President for Operations Jim Bailey are on trial charged with creating a front company, supposedly a minority-owned company, to illegally secure millions of dollars in contracts from the city of Cincinnati. After almost 4 weeks of testimony, the case is about to be turned over to the jury. To discuss developments in the trial, we are joined by WCPO reporter Paula Christian, who is following this case. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Paula, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Let's just be clear about some basics. Are Doug Evans and Jim Bailey facing exactly the same set
of
charges?
They are. They are facing six charges related to wire fraud. There's a couple wire frauds, a couple conspiracies, and then a misprision of a felony, which is knowing about a crime and not doing anything to stop it.
Now, other people have already pleaded guilty to this and then become – they've been called to testify.
Yes.
So how many people have already been said, I'm guilty of one of these charges?
Well, four, which is quite a few. And so we have two former CFOs for Evans Landscaping. They both pleaded guilty to a lesser charge and testified at trial. There's a former general manager who wrote a lot of these contracts for the state. He pleaded guilty and testified. And then the man at the heart of all of it, Corey Jordan, who was supposedly the figurehead for this shell company, he pleaded guilty as well. And he testified very dramatically in court a couple of weeks ago.
Okay, so all those people have come to court, told their stories.
Yes.
But they've already admitted that they have done something. And that's really the way federal prosecutors work.
Sure
they,
is.
They build the case.
Yep, they're always looking for the head of the snake.
As the prosecution laid out its case, what did they present? How much paper evidence did they have versus testimony by people about this is what I did or this is what I think was the intention of what somebody did?
Well, this case was absolutely incredible in the amount of documents that were produced. Over 1 million documents through four search warrants, hundreds of thousands of emails. Not all of that came in, obviously, but the FBI agent in charge of the case was on the stand for, I believe, 2 days. And for the majority of it, he was just introducing email evidence. So I would say, my gosh, how many emails read in court? Hundreds.
So for the prosecutors, what's the key thing they have to prove before they, you know, they're going to send this case to the jury? Probably next Monday, right, after closing arguments?
Yes.
Okay. So what's the key thing that they have to prove?
Well, the key to this whole case is intent. It is, what did Doug Evans and Jim Bailey and Evans Landscaping intend to do with this company? Was it an innocent mistake? Was it just bad advice from some advisors? Or did they intentionally plan to defraud the city of Cincinnati and the state of Ohio for contracts that were supposed to go to minority and small businesses by trying to take them themselves?
And this was triggered, this whole case is triggered, I guess, by one, standards for certain types of contracts, particularly in the city of Cincinnati, for minority contractors. And secondly, by a downturn in business by the Great Recession that really hit Evans Landscaping hard.
Yes.
And this was the argument for the prosecutors is this company, Evans, was looking for a way to get business that it really didn't have a right to. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very interesting sort of confluence of events. The Great Recession in 2007 and 2008, housing industry was in a downturn. Doug Evans testified that he was trying to find a way to get more business so he didn't have to lay off any of his 250 employees. At the same time, he's got a friend, an IT employee who's an African-American who is looking to start a new venture. So he thought, you know, I could partner with him for this minority business. Now, the prosecutors are saying at the same time, you know, the city made a lot of its demolition jobs that used to be open to anybody strictly for minorities. So all of a sudden, Evans was, you know, at a loss for some of this work.
So the testimony of Corey Jordan had to be critical here for the prosecutor's case. What did he say about how much he wanted to create this company, he was in control of the company, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, he was very emotional on the witness stand. He cried several times. He basically apologized for what he did, saying that he was a black man in this city and he hurt his race by doing this. He said he had no control over the company at all. He said that he had to ask Doug Evans for basic things like gas or a laptop, which he sent email after email asking him for months. He said that he would go in and sign 20 blank checks at a time and just leave them. I think that, you know, initially he was interested in maybe starting a business, but it you know, depending on who you believe, it certainly didn't end up that way.
So if intent is key, then the testimony of Doug Evans particularly is also key.
Yes.
And he was on the stand this week.
Yeah, and that was kind of a surprise because, you know, you never know if the defendant's going to take the stand. And in a case like this, it's sort of a 50-50 chance. And his attorney, Ben Dusing, declined to tell me in advance if Doug would take the stand. So it was a surprise to see him on the witness stand.
How did he do? And knowing full well here that intent is the critical crux point of this, his explanation had to counter Corey Jordan. So how would you, what did he have to say?
Well, when he was under direct examination by Ben Dusing, I thought he did very well. And you know, he read aloud a lot of emails and text messages that he had sent to Corey over the years, you know, trying to mentor him, trying to help him, trying to encourage him to go out and get some business. So, you know, that certainly bolstered what he's been trying to say from the beginning. He did undergo a really brutal cross-examination by Assistant U.S. Attorney Tim Mangan, who kept him up there for several hours and just read email after email after email, in which, you know, Doug Evans either wrote the email or was CC'd on it, giving direct orders on how to run this company. In some cases, Doug said he had never seen these emails. And in one case, in particular, an email that was sent about Ergon, he said he never wrote it. So, you know, those are questions for the jury. We'll have to decide who they believe.
So, has Evans Landscaping been able to stay in business during this period of time? Have they been able to, you know, the recession's over, were they able to rebuild their business? Have they been able to move forward here?
Oh, I think they've grown. I mean, Ben Dusing has said all along, you know, before the trial started, Doug Evans still gets up at 6:30 in the morning, goes to work every day. He's a very hard worker. I mean, they employ 250 people. They have annual sales of $35 million. I mean, that's a pretty successful company from something that was – he started as a teenager with a shovel and a pickup truck full of mulch. So you still see the trucks all over town. I will say quite a few employees were in court day after day. I mean, there were dozens of people there wearing Evans uniforms. So,
in effect, that sounds like a show of support.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So these two different interpretations of – and did the co-defendant also testify in this case?
No, he didn't. Jim Bailey did not testify, which, you know, again, it goes to his strategy. From the beginning, you know, Jim Bailey has tried to kind of distance himself from this whole thing and really shape his role in it as just being the guy who assigns the trucks to the job and assigns the guys to the job and really isn't part of much strategy, management decision, anything like that. His name really hasn't come up as much at all in trial.
So again, if intent is key,
yes,
his argument would be
nothing to do with this.
So what actually tipped federal authorities off to this, that there might have been
wondered that. Well, you know, the FBI agent who testified said they started looking into this in late 2013. So it could have come from, I don't know for sure, but it could have come from the city. Two City of Cincinnati employees testified about how they got a lot of complaints about Evans being on site at Ergon Jobs. And a number of contractors complained to the city about it. So it could have come from that. Also, there was a lawsuit. When Ergon and Evans had their falling out, Evans sued for over $200,000, saying Ergon owed them this money. So, and then in his countersuit, Corey Jordan laid out this list of allegations that, you know, read by the federal authorities could certainly have sounded illegal.
So if, first off, if Doug Evans and or Bailey
yes.
are found guilty, would Evans Landscaping be liable to people who had issued contracts for them, for the city of Cincinnati? Could they claw back money?
I don't think so, because there's no dispute that the city of Cincinnati and the state of Ohio, they got the work done that they paid for. The jobs were done. There were no complaints about the work not getting done. So there's nothing to recoup. The worst that would happen is that Evans Landscaping does face a $1.25 million fine because the company itself is charged criminally. So the jury could find that the company is liable, but that Doug Evans and Jim Bailey are not. So then the company would be fined, but nobody would go to prison.
Okay. And should they be found guilty, one or both, how much time are they facing?
Well, technically, if they're convicted of all six charges, they face up to 103 years in prison. But, I mean, you know how the federal charges work. They're not going to serve anything close to that if they got convicted.
Well, one way or the other, they're not going to serve 103 years in prison.
No, that's right.
So there is the years in prison, but also the potential fine.
Absolutely.
And that fine would then go to the federal government, not to entities that contracted with them. So— closing arguments on Monday?
Yes, and it will be several hours of closing arguments. It'll be 90 minutes for the prosecution, 90 minutes for each of the defense, and then they'll get to come back a little bit at the end. So the jury's looking at, oh my gosh, 4 to 5 hours of closing arguments. And then Judge Barrett said they can either start deliberating late Monday or they can just pick up the case Tuesday morning.
Okay, and then once that happens, we're all just waiting.
Yep, okay. That's it.
Well, Paula Christian, thank you very much for being here today.
And my pleasure.
Keeping abreast of this really important trial. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. From 30,000 feet, recent elections in Kentucky seem to deliver more continuity than change. But looking more closely, voters in some communities swept officials out with clear mandate for change. To explore recent developments statewide in Kentucky and locally in Northern Kentucky, we are joined now by Associated Press reporter Adam Beam and River City News publisher Michael Monks. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Adam, Michael, welcome in both cases back to Cincinnati Edition.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. Adam, strange sort of set of events down in Frankfort with the House of Representatives in terms of leadership decisions by the really overwhelming Republican majority, the supermajority that's down there. Talk about the new speaker, the leadership, and how it was put together. It's kind of interesting, some twists and turns here.
That's right. The new speaker, well, technically not the speaker yet. He has to be voted on by the full House of Representatives. But since Republicans have currently 61 seats, it's guaranteed that he's going to win. His name is David Osborne. He's a real estate agent and a horse farmer from Oldham County. And they elected a pretty much whole new leadership team. There's five of them. David Mead is the pro tem. Bam Carney is the floor leader. Suzanne Miles is the caucus chairwoman. And Chad McCoy is the whip. And the day after that these leaders were elected, they decided to fire the communications director for the House Republican Caucus. Her name is Daisy Olivo. And she has a pending lawsuit against the state because she claims that she reported sexual harassment of four Republican lawmakers. And she claims that after she reported this, she was punished. She was stripped of her job responsibilities and basically demoted. And she has stayed on. It's been more than a year since she filed this law, or almost a year since she filed this lawsuit. She has stayed on and has not lost her job, but really has just kind of been effectively ostracized, has not had any access to the leaders and doesn't really do much. But the day after the new leadership elections, they fired her, and she most likely will be adding that to her lawsuit as evidence that she was punished.
Well, in addition to that, although not in the very top leadership, one of the people who was involved in that settlement, which was private, and we still don't know exactly the testimony and the charges and specifics, was Michael Meredith, who was restored to a leadership position as chair of the House Local Government Committee. He was one of the four people who settled. And so in combination of his restoration to a position of significance and the firing of Daisy Olivo, it just seems to me like the Republican Party here is basically saying, we just don't care. What about those suburban women voters out there?
Well, it's interesting. You know, it really has almost turned into a partisan issue here. I spent some time in the days after Representative Meredith was named to the local government committee chairman, calling a lot of the female members of the House, both Republican and Democrats. And there, so far, the Republican women that I've spoken with are fine with this. They say that, you know, that matter is settled. It's behind them. They got to move on. And, you know, they like Representative Meredith. He's always been polite to them, and they see no problem with it. And then, of course, I speak with the Democratic representatives, and they say, well, you know, we're rewarding bad behavior here. We have no policy in place on how to handle these complaints, and this is just going to, you know, we're just showing that there's no consequences when we do stuff like this.
Isn't there a potential, though, as the complaint from Daisy Olivo goes forward and is heard, that what is behind that, what was behind the original charge, becomes public? It's been suppressed at this point, but couldn't that come out and then we got a whole new set of problems on our hands?
That's right. I mean, we know some things. We know, but there was some charges, a complaint before the Legislative Ethics Commission. They released, you know, pages and pages of text messages between the former speaker and this woman who made the allegations. So we know some of the things that happened, but most of it, including what Michael Meredith and the other Republican lawmakers are accused of doing, we don't know much at all. And as part of Daisy Olivo's civil lawsuit, the woman who made these accusations gave a deposition for several hours. And in this deposition, apparently, she goes into graphic detail explaining everything that happened to her. And names these lawmakers. And that deposition was going to be made public as part of the court file, but these lawmakers, three of them, including Michael Meredith and Jeff Hoover, have filed a motion to try to ask the court to seal parts of that testimony because they say it violates the confidential settlement that she has signed. And so that is still to be decided. The judge is going to have another hearing on that later this month. And, you know, now that these lawmakers, they're actually asking to cross-examine her to kind of rebut her claims. And she's fighting that. She's saying, look, if you wanted to litigate this, you could have litigated it, but we settled it instead, and now you're coming back trying to cross-examine me. But these lawmakers are saying, look, well, we have a right to do this because, you know, all these details are going to come out, and we have a right to present our side. So it's really an interesting legal question. The lawyers for Daisy say that these lawmakers don't even have a right to be part of the lawsuit. So all of that has to be worked out.
So we could hear more of this in the months coming up.
Absolutely.
Is the point. I want to go over to another topic, which more substantive, and we might be able to get Michael Monks involved in this discussion as well. And that is the Kentucky Board of Education voted finally on some transition readiness requirements for graduates of Kentucky high schools. And let's begin, though, Adam Beam, why don't you begin by just clarifying what's in these and also then we, I want to talk about how to characterize what actually did get elected or selected.
These are new minimum requirements for high school graduation. So for anybody in the state of Kentucky to get a high school diploma, these are the bare minimum things you have to do. And they go into effect beginning in the year of 2023, the class of 2023. And the proposal has changed somewhat since it was first introduced. But basically, you have to show basic competency in reading and math. And you can do that either by getting a minimum score on some state testing that is taken in the 8th or the 10th grade. And you can also do it by not doing a test. You can put together a portfolio of your work, which demonstrates that you've met the standard, present it to your local school superintendent. They can approve it. You can get it that way. The other thing is they want you to show that you are at least trying to be prepared for a career or college. So they have a list of qualifiers, or 7 of them, and you have to meet one of them. Now, you can do this in several ways. You can meet a benchmark score on the ACT or even a college placement exam, which is a little less rigorous than a college entrance exam. You can complete an apprenticeship program. You can complete at least 500 hours of exceptional work experience. There's lots of different ways you can meet that. And the goal is, because we have, while Kentucky has one of the highest graduation rates in the country, we graduate about 90% of high school seniors every year. Only about 60% of them meet standards showing that they're ready for college, that they're ready for a career. And that leaves Republican leaders and some of the education advocates in the state to question the value of the degree that we're handing out.
Well, I do want to remind listeners that we did an entire show on this, both half the show focused on Kentucky and half the show focused on Ohio, probably about two and a half weeks ago. So you can go back and get some really detailed information. So this is finally something now has passed. Michael Monks, what have you heard from the education people in Northern Kentucky about the reaction to what was finally adopted?
Well, what's interesting to see from superintendents in Northern Kentucky is sort of a hesitancy to be excited about anything that's coming out of Frankfort. You may recall that the legislature last year upset a lot of the educators across the state, and you had superintendents in Northern Kentucky who were particularly fired up about some of the reform bills that were down there. As far as these changes go, I've not heard a lot of reaction out of the superintendents. They're just still very trepidatious about where anybody who's a member of the Bevin administration may be altering anything that has to do with education in the state. And they're particularly concerned about charter schools. And that's especially true in the River City districts, the independent districts along the river in Covington and Newport and Bellevue and Dayton. Those are their main concerns right now.
Adam, does that sort of characterize what you're hearing from other parts of the state?
Absolutely. I don't think there was a single education advocacy group that endorsed these new requirements. All of them either opposed or they asked for the state board to table it and come back and try again later. So there was a lot of skepticism about this plan. Mainly the concerns were, how would it impact minority students? There was a concern that it would reduce Kentucky's graduation rate and particularly harm students of color.
Well, Adam Beam, I want to thank you for joining us today. We're going to turn our attention now to some Northern Kentucky news and developments. And Michael Monks, I think, is the person who just digs in on that. So thank you very much and look forward to having you back again.
Thanks again.
Okay. Michael, is the Ovation Project in Newport, which we've heard about for, I don't know, 15 years, is it on track again?
Well, I have to tell you, I wrote an article about this just a couple of weeks ago, and I was excited to write this article because you think, oh, this is one of those great articles that people are going to share, and it's going to get a lot of clicks for you. I saw a lot of suspicion in response from the community. So as far as the officials involved with the Ovation Project, the answer to your question is yes. The city says, yes, it's going forward. And most importantly, Corporex, the owner and developer of the site, says, yes, finally, everything has fallen into place. We're going to put shovels in the ground. We're going to start building something on that massive empty lot at the corner of the Ohio and Licking Rivers. Something's finally going to happen there. As for the people out in the community, they're not so sure. It's like fool me once kind of thing.
When do the developers say something's going to go into the ground?
Well, the city of Newport extended the TIF agreement with Corporex that was developed more than 10 years ago for this project. And now that the Route 9 project has completed, that's also known as Licking Pike. For those of you who drive around in northern Kentucky, Licking Pike is now pretty well all the way connected through the riverfront in Newport. Huge deal for this particular project. So Corporex is saying early next year that they're going to start building on this. Now, that doesn't mean that we're going to get something in terms of an attraction like the aquarium yet, but what they're promising so far is that they're going to start to build what will eventually be the parking garage and the lower level base upon which everything else is going to be built. And I looked Corporex manager Tom Bant in the eye and asked him, you know, I mean, this is for real. This is really happening. And they say, yes, this is really happening. And Corporex is very busy right now. I mean, they are moving forward on a lot of things. They're turning an empty office building in the Covington Riverfront next to the Marriott there. It's called Madison Place. They're turning that into a residential project. They sold about $70 million worth of their hotels to start funding the Ovation project. So they appear to be moving on some things that have been long stale.
Well, I want to take a look at another development project, but it has political implications in Northern Kentucky, and that is Villa Hills. This last election, and people who don't follow Northern Kentucky politics may not have focused on this one, but, you know, as I said in the beginning, there was a lot of continuity in the elections in early November. Not in Villa Hills. What happened?
Well, honestly, across Northern Kentucky, it was a bloodbath for incumbents. And that's something that never really happens in a place like Northern Kentucky. And it usually has to do with the fact of the limited media access. And so there's not a lot of conversations. But we saw multiple cities lose multiple incumbents in the city buildings. Nowhere worse than Villa Hills. Five of six city council members lost, and the incumbent mayor lost. So that's six out of seven members that make up the legislative body in the city voted out of office. And let's reference the mayor. That's Butch Callery. This is a towering figure in Northern Kentucky municipal politics for a long time. He was the mayor of Covington for 8 years and was also a city commissioner there for about two decades before moving to Villa Hills and becoming the mayor there. And the instigator for this massive change in Villa Hills, which is this posh, affluent, suburban community along the riverfront to the west of Ludlow and Bromley, is a massive development that other communities would love to have. I mean, you could not ask for this type of development to land in your doorstep the way this one has. It's called Sanctuary Village. It's going to be built on land that is currently occupied by the St. Walburg Monastery. The sale of that land is to fund
the Benedictine sisters. It's
the sale of that land is to fund the retirement for these nuns. And when the plan came to fruition, after 2 years of community dialogue, conversation, discussion, adoption of planning, zoning types of things, the residents rose up when they saw that there was going to be a four-story apartment building included.
Four-story.
A four-story apartment building, yes. And that is not something that you find in a place like Villa Hills. And it's also going to have a lot of commercial and but
– so it's mixed use.
It's mixed use. So there's single-family homes. But this is Villa Hills. This isn't going to be cheap stuff. This is going to be very nice, very expensive stuff. But the residents who live adjacent to that started to get angry first. These people formed a political action committee, Dan, for a Villa Hills mayoral and city council race. There was a PAC in this race, and it worked. So they're in legal battles currently. They lost the first round in the courts to try to stop the development. It doesn't look like the law is on their side. It looks like the city followed all the right procedures to allow this development to move forward, but it's currently in the appeal process.
I do want to point out that I do know any number of people in Villa Hills. One of the issues was the very name, Sanctuary Village, feeling that this somehow is related. I mean, it's obviously a reference to the religious character of the Benedictine sisters, the sanctuary, but it sounds like a political statement to some people in Villa Hills. And how would they dare name anything Sanctuary Village?
I don't think you're wrong about that.
I know I'm not wrong because I talk to people.
Yeah, and so do I. And it certainly has some religious connotations to it, but it's also adjacent to Villa Madonna Academy, which is a Catholic school and shares half a name with the city that it's located in. So I don't know if the Lord is watching this proceedings very closely, but if he is, we'll see which side he comes down
on. So you
on.
Say the law may allow this to go forward even though there's been all this change? Who's the developer?
The developer is Ashley Commercial Group, a very well-respected, long-established, family-owned Northern Kentucky development firm. They are involved in primarily suburban development, but they're a little bit involved now in some of the urban core stuff that's going on. They developed the building at Pike and Madison, known as the Mutual Building, where the River City News is located, I should disclose, and the Hannaford Bar that people might know about. The Jimmy John's is a good locator. And they're also involved in the Kent Building redevelopment of a massive warehouse in Bellevue. So these are guys who have a very well-established reputation in the community. But for whatever reason, once that apartment building came on the horizon, the residents of Villa Hills were upset.
Do they say that that four-story apartment building is the linchpin, and if you don't have four stories and that sort of density, it doesn't make economic sense?
I think that there's concern about density. There's also a lot of concern from the residents about traffic. I mean, you're talking about Amsterdam Road. You're talking about a lot of traffic, particularly around entrance and dismissal around Villa Madonna Academy, which is there nearby. A lot of these issues were addressed in the planning process, is what the city argues. They say that this is something that we are addressing. They are creating a TIF around there as well to generate funds to address those roads. The state's going to be involved in some of this. They assured the residents that traffic is going to be helped because of this development. The voters of Villa Hills and the group Defend Villa Hills, I should note is the name of that PAC, they weren't buying it either. So again, their appeal is currently in the hands of a judge in Kenton County.
And there's another twist to this in that the mayor and the city council, or at least some city council members who are now lame ducks, wanted to provide for the city administrator, and now that's become an issue, right?
Yeah, you know, we had Adam Beam on the line. I thought, you know, sometimes I envy the guys in Frankfurt because it's not as brutal as Northern Kentucky politics. And this is a really strange story because the city administrator is a guy named Craig Bowman, also a former Covington City Commissioner who worked in the Butch Callery years in Covington.
What a surprise.
Yeah, well, he's been there for about 7 or 8 years now, and obviously was one of the shepherds of this project. And so everyone else at the city building gets voted out. He's not someone who's put on the ballot, but in a lot of ways, the city administrators are on the ballot in contentious election years. So now the lame duck members of the city council have put together what Defend Villa Hills has characterized as a golden parachute. It would basically be a contract with Craig Bowman that says if he's fired, he would get 18 months severance. But it would also, if he doesn't get fired, he gets a car and those sorts of things that are not previously afforded to a city administrator in a city of about 7,000 people. There's been no indication that new mayor Heather Jansen plans to fire Craig Bowman, which she will have the executive authority to do in her role as mayor in Villa Hills. But it's suspected that there would be a change in that capacity at some point. So you have to keep in mind, there are some very serious things happening in Villa Hills. This huge development, unlike anything they've ever seen, is on the horizon. And they have all fresh faces coming into the city building, and they could have a fresh city administrator as well. So how this is all navigated is going to be something very important to watch.
This is why local politics is important. This is where people live.
Precisely.
And they care about where they live. So, Michael Monks, thank you for being here today. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Crafting a Hamilton County budget for 2019 has been even more complex than normal after the commissioners withdrew a sales tax increase they initially adopted, leaving a $28 million hole. One strategy to plug that hole involves stepping back again from fully funding the stadium property tax rollback promised to Hamilton County voters in 1996. To discuss the latest news on the county budget and other developments, we are joined now by Cincinnati Enquirer regional government reporter Scott Wortman and WVXU Hamilton County reporter Bill Reinhart. You can join the discussion by calling 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Scott, Bill, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Happy to be here.
So, Bill, if I understand right, you were at a luncheon today where the newly elected but not yet sworn in Hamilton County Commissioner Stephanie Dumas was a speaker. Is
correct.
That, did she speak?
She spoke at the Government Strategies luncheon this afternoon. And it was kind of a get to know you type meeting. It was not long on policy details. It was basically, here's who I am, here's kind of some generalities of what I stand for, and a little bit of what to look for in the upcoming session.
And so what were some of – what was she talking about with the upcoming session? What are her passions?
Transportation. That was pretty much first out of the gate for her. And she says, you know, I realize this is a – there are very simple fixes for local transit, the bus system, but it is going to cost us some money. The equipment is antiquated. The accessibility is not what it should be. And she says the suburbs are not paying their fair share, and she wants to see a little more contribution, some kicking in from the suburbs for the transit authority.
And does she have a favorite way to pay for that?
No. No. that was not one of the specifics that was covered.
Which, of course, is the specific that we all stumble over all the time.
That's always the way, isn't it?
Details, details, details.
Yes. She also talked early childhood education is a big passion for her. She's for it. Affordable housing is a major issue as well. And she says, you know, this is one of those things that's connected to a lot of other issues. Mm-hmm. If you solve one, it's going to improve life in other areas. And affordable housing is one of those things.
Well, Scott, at the moment, Stephanie Dumas, who is a Democrat, by the way, and when yes. she is sworn in early January, it will make a three-person Democratic controlled
yes.
county commission, but
correct.
She's not there now, mm-hmm. and it's a 2-to-1 split with two Democrats in control of the commission. Where do we stand on the budget at this moment, and what are the prospects?
Well, it's a $29 million deficit that they're going to have to figure out how to plug. They're looking at ways to raise money, raising the real estate transfer fee.
What is that?
That's a fee that people pay when they sell a home or a piece of property.
And is right that now paid by the seller?
It's paid by the seller.
Okay.
Yes, correct. That's just one of many ways they're looking at raising funds and cuts to just different various departments that they're going to vote on. And is it next Wednesday or – I think it's next Wednesday, in the next week or two. So
yeah, I don't know that they'll vote on it next Wednesday.
Yeah.
I think they may
in the next
talk,
couple weeks.
Yeah, they have until the end of the month to approve a budget.
Well mm-hmm. –
One of the things, oddly enough, that's gotten the most people worked up, I mean, relatively speaking, because it's been at public meetings, is a $30,000 cut to a 4-H director. So you just never know what's going to resonate and get people stirred up. But yeah. it's things like that they're looking at cutting.
And where is the 4-H director? Where does the 4-H director fit into the structure of county government in an urbanized county like this?
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah.
I mean, like the fairgrounds has always been kind of an odd, kind of a square peg in a round hole here in Hamilton County. So, I mean, that's a good question. That's, I guess, one of the reasons why it was top on the list.
Yeah, the budget pamphlet that was handed out, the governor, was an overview of the entire budget. I couldn't find it immediately because I didn't know what category to look under and had to have it pointed out to me. And I had to do that because, as Scott said, so many people talked about how the importance of this one position. I mean, $30,000.
What's important
in the grand
to
scheme.
People in that position? What did they speak to? Why is this important to people?
Well, because that person works with kids a lot, and those kids may not have educational opportunities like other children do, and the educational opportunities that are part of this 4-H program are not something they're probably going to get in school. And it's not just agricultural or animal-based learning. All these people said, look, there's all kinds of things that 4-H does. And I know 4-H for years has said, hey, we're more than just about raising goats and sheep.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just for the children who live in rural parts of the county,
yeah.
but also
mm-hmm.
for people who
– Yeah, there's apparently a big – 4-H club on the west side, Price Hill.
And it is, I believe Commissioner Denise Driehaus has often described the county, because the county is like a big budget, basically. And when things get cut, you notice it later on once it's gone. So it's something that – a lot of subtle things that people, you know, will notice down the road.
Well, we're talking not $30,000 but much larger chunks of money.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the sheriff's department, the justice center,
mm-hmm.
those are where the big cuts are, right?
Yes.
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 And another big thing, too, that could be coming down the road are increased 911 fees, the local townships and municipalities that then they'll might force them, your township, to raise taxes or find ways to come up with that money.
Yeah, there were sheriff's patrols eliminated for some of the western townships that are not paying extra to get those. County's contribution to the fusion center, county's contribution to the heroin task force would all be cut. And then on top of all that, there's an across-the-board cut for every department. Spending is down. A lot of positions are going to go unfilled.
I was actually really surprised to see that cut for the heroin task force. I mean, it seemed to me that that's – we spend so much time as a community to help make people aware of the problem of – the opioid problem. I was a little surprised by that.
That may be a bit of a misnomer because it was pointed out we may not be paying for it out of the general fund, but we believe we can find funds somewhere else. We can find money from somewhere else to help pay for heroin task force and the opioid epidemic.
Okay. What about the sheriff's department's reaction to, you know, the sort of big numbers that are being cut there?
I mean, I haven't really heard him yet react.
He hasn't come to any of the meetings to say, oh, you can't do this. This is just horrible. And I seem to recall hearing, well, he'll be able to do this. He'll be able to move some funds around from restricted funds to pay for this and that. So it may not be the end of the world for the sheriff's office.
And in years past, too, sometimes he's just not heeded that and blown past his budget. So, you know, we'll see.
It's another approach to budgeting.
Yeah.
All right. There's also been sort of an interesting – there was an interesting moment at County Commission this week when Jeff Birding, I think if I understand this correctly, somewhat in a surprise to the commissioner, showed up and spoke from the floor – As a member of the community. What happened here, Scott?
Well, and it was interesting because I saw someone online say, wow, Todd Portune's on fire. And you don't normally hear people say that with Todd Portune. But Jeff Birding came in to the last meeting. And I'm like, what's he doing here? Because it wasn't on the agenda. So he gets up to speak during the public portion part of the meeting.
So he took a card out and 2 minutes to speak, right?
Yeah, 2 minutes to speak. And he's tells the commission because the commission is supposed to build a garage for his soccer team stadium, FC Cincinnati. And he told the commission, look, you guys voted on this 3 times. I want you to stand by your commitment. The county now is looking at building 2 separate garages, not directly on the stadium site, kind of in the vicinity. And Todd Portune was not happy with Jeff Birding coming to an open meeting and saying that. Portune took offense, saying that Birding's trying to act like the county's not standing up to its commitment, and he basically read the Riot Act to Jeff Birding.
If I understood this correctly, and I'm not sure I did, I wasn't there. For Todd Portune, he indicated that he and Birding had a conversation
on Friday,
and he thought things were going in one direction, and then to have Birding show up and do this publicly as a surprise was, as much as anything, maybe even more than the content of what Birding was saying. That's what he took offense at.
Yeah, the first words out of Todd's mouth were basically, what? Where is this coming from? What are you talking about?
He said, I don't understand what you're talking about, Jeff. Yeah. That was his first statement after a pause. Yeah. And I don't know exactly what Jeff's strategy was, if it's just brinksmanship trying to get the public against the commission, the pressure room, or what. But it didn't seem to work on Wednesday.
So what was Jeff Birding's – I mean, he's standing there. He has his say. Todd then makes it very clear where he – what was Jeff Birding's reaction to that?
Well, he looked like he wanted to say something, but Todd shut him down. You had your 2 minutes, and so
that's why I said 2 minutes.
Jeff and an associate just walked out after that without saying a word.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's where it stands right now.
So he didn't comment to the members of the press or anybody about what.
No, they just walked out.
What about the substance of this? Is there a question here? This idea of splitting into multiple garages. You two have followed this. Is there a violation of the understanding,
spirit?
Or the spirit, or the
the letter, the spirit, whatever, of what had been agreed to?
I mean, it's not for me to say specifically, but yeah, the understanding I think everyone had when it was passed was it's a garage for FC Cincinnati. The agreement, though, left a lot of wiggle room intentionally on location and exactly what it would look like. So the agreement legally is not holding the county to one garage or two separate garages. But, I mean, I don't think anyone thought it was going to be a garage for anything else but the soccer stadium. I mean, that's why they passed it.
But certainly, if you're going to build a garage, you want it to be used other than just during soccer games.
Sure.
Otherwise, you can't pay for it.
And that's what Jeff Birding said. He said, look, this is going to be, you know, neighbors are going to be able to use this. Music hall patrons are going to be able to use this. But as Todd Portune pointed out, when we voted on this, the idea was the stadium was going to be built in Oakley, which is a completely different story than building it in the West End. You've got a lot more space in Oakley to build a parking garage. The West End, not so much. You're a little more limited.
Well, and the idea of splitting it and having part of it up to serve Findlay Market, which is a whole different clientele. By the way, we were talking about budget, and I kind of lost track because I got specific on some of the cut side. But on the revenue side, the stadium tax rollback. This really upsets a lot of people, and this is another chapter in a long book about how this has been handled. So, Bill, where do we stand on that?
Jeff Aluto, the county administrator, had recommended a property tax rollback of $5 million, considerably less than the full amount it would be, a lot less. Commissioners ultimately decided to go with $8 million for this year, and that's still a lot less than if the property tax rebate would be fully funded.
Well, and if it was even not fully funded, but funded in the way it was last year,
which was about $16
million, $16 million,
which is about 75% of what was promised. Yeah.
So we're still, it's not only short from where the ideal.
Yeah, I think they said the last time it was fully funded was 2016.
Yeah.
Does that sound familiar?
The last, since 2011, they've only fully funded it twice.
And the reason for this is that because they don't have the money to pay off the bonds for the stadium, right?
Yeah. Yes. The sale in the 90s, they projected to sell this. The stadium sales tax that, yeah, it'll make enough where you'll be able to give 30% back.
3% growth every year.
Yes.
And it has not reached that.
It's just been this little thing called online purchasing.
And then in the last year, they've lost the Medicaid sales tax as well. So that was a big moneymaker. Well, I don't say moneymaker, but it was a revenue source for the county that they can't count on anymore.
Well, always fun over at the courthouse. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having
me. Scott Wortman, Bill Reinhardt. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.